Blog Talk Radio.
I write, and you can also get our past show archives by going to SusanKnowles.com. That's SusanKnowles.com. So glad that you could be here with us today. You know, there's been a lot, just an awful lot in the news lately regarding ISIS, Iran, Yemen. You know, we've been doing this nuclear weapons treaty with Iran. We've been negotiating it for a while, kind of gone over our deadline, and then supposedly we've finally reached this tentative agreement. We've known about in the news Iran in Yemen and us supporting the Saudis against Iran in Yemen and at the same time negotiating with them. We've also been hearing a lot about ISIS in the Middle East. So I wanted to invite somebody on who was a real expert on what's going on in the Middle East to give us some ideas of what's really happening. You know, is what we're hearing, is that the truth, or is there something else that we don't know? So, as I said, our guest today is an expert on the Middle East, and he is an Iranian-American, and I hopefully I'll pronounce his name correctly. It's Majid Ravizadeh, and I want to tell you a little bit about him. He's an American political scientist, scholar at Harvard University, a policy analyst, author, and commentator on U.S. foreign policy and the Middle East. He's president and director of the International American Council on the Middle East and serves on the board of the Harvard International Review. He's originally from the Islamic Republic of Iran and Syria. is a member of the Gulf 2000 Middle East Project of the Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and served as a senior fellow at Nonviolence International. He's also a journalist and human rights activist. He's frequently called upon to brief U.S., EU, and Asian officials about U.S. foreign policy and Middle Eastern affairs. He has taught at several universities, such as the University of California, Santa Barbara, through a Fulbright teaching scholarship, has been a recipient of several fellowships and scholarships, including from Oxford University, Annenberg, and the University of Santa Barbara. His analysis and research are regularly used to brief various institutions and parliaments, including the UK Parliament. Previously, he worked at the United Nations International Committee for the Red Cross and conducted research at Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and Council on U.S.-Arab Relations. As a political scientist and scholar, he regularly appears on national and international outlets, including CNN, BBC World TV and Radio, ABC, Al Jazeera, Fox News, and many more. He is frequently quoted. He writes for academic and non-academic publications and contributes to many respected international news outlets, including New York Times International, Los Angeles Times, CNN, Jerusalem Post, USA Today, and many others. As a public speaker, he is frequently invited to speak at universities, academic, non-academic, and diplomatic conferences and conferences on foreign affairs. So I'd like to welcome to the show, Majid. How are you today?
Good. Thank you so much, Susan. Thank you for having me. And I think that was very detailed bio of me. Now I feel more pressure to answer how to answer your question.
Well, great. And I hope I didn't pronounce your last name too incorrectly. Could you pronounce that for us?
No, I think it was absolutely correct. I think you are among the select group of people who can pronounce my name first time accurately. It is Rafizadeh, so Majid Rafizadeh.
Great, thank you.
It's an Iranian last name. I think you can guess from the DEH at the end.
Yes, and I wanted to ask you, kind of get a little information about you before we get started.
Yes.
You know, where were you born and how long have you been in the U.S. and questions like that?
Yes, so I was born in a city called Isfahan. It's in the center of Iran. My father is Iranian and my mother is Syrian. It's an interesting combination. If people know, there is a Syrians are predominantly Arab, Iranian call themselves Persian, and Arab and Persian don't get along with each other. But anyway, my father and mother, they were able to get along. And I was born in Iran. I grew up in Iran and in Syria and studied there. I worked for different human rights groups. And then I came to the States 5 years and a half ago. And through Fulbright scholarship, and I became citizen 2 years ago. Actually, 1 year and a half ago. So it's been a very intriguing journey for me. But I grew up in the both Arab and you can call Persian world, learning the social, political, and legal rights of people there and how they live on a daily basis.
Oh, that's very interesting background that you have, and you've done a lot, you know, that I just read, as you know, but you've done a lot for Iran and American studies as well.
Thank you so much. You also have done a brilliant work so far, Susan.
Well, thank you. I wanted to kind of jump right in to what's been going on with this Iranian nuclear treaty deal. You know, what are the, if you know, and people that you've talked to, what are the Iranians saying about Obama? You know, he came out and said right after the deadline passed and we didn't have a deal, and then about a day or two later he comes out and says, oh, we have a deal. You know, we've agreed upon this. And then immediately the Iranian supreme leader turns around and says, no, we don't have a deal. So what's really going on?
Right. So this is a very great question, Susan. I think people are usually confused. They receive mixed messages, right? Mixed news from different places. So I was reading, I went to the Persian website. I went to the government official website of Iran. And the message they're sending, it's completely different from the message that President Obama is sending. Clearly, President Obama is trying to send a message which can convince the American public that his foreign policy toward Iran or his nuclear deal is a great deal, and he want to leave a really good legacy for himself. But is that message right? The news which I read from Iranian leaders or from other websites, or from other sources I've been talking to, it seems that Obama's version of the what is going on in the negotiation is completely different from their version. They actually accused, on a Fars News, which is the Iran government official website, they accused Obama for having a false report, a fact sheet, which was published on the State Department Press Office website. They accused the fact sheet. They said this is not what we talked about in the negotiation talks. And so they have their own version. And I think even though President Obama tried to say it's a deal, it's not a deal. There hasn't been a deal. A deal is a deal when you have everything written up and all the relevant parties sign off on that paper. That's when we call it a deal. But
that's
what is
when it's
now happening?
Deal.
Yes, what is happening now? It's all just words, talks, and frameworks, and different interpretation. The Iranian leader are saying, "Well, the talks we had, we agreed that the U.S. will lift the sanctions immediately after we sign the deal at the end of the June." President Obama is saying, and according to the State Department press office, is that no, the sanction will be lifted, after IAEA verify that Iran is complying with the deal. So it's really hard to believe which one is telling the truth. You know, there is a proverbial story, if I can just tell it in Persian,
sure,
that was going through tweets. It was interesting. That reflects, the idea, the notion that who really you can believe. It's, the story is that a peasant sees a fox carrying a bag, and in the bag, the fox, you can see the tail of a chicken. And the peasant asks the fox, are you stealing a chicken? The fox said, no, I swear to Imam, the supreme leader, that I'm not stealing any chicken. Then the peasant said, I don't know who to believe your swearing to a supreme leader or to believe the tale which I'm seeing in the bag. So it's really difficult to believe what is it true. Is it what President Obama saying is the truth or what Iranian leaders are saying are the truth? So you have here different interpretation, but each side wants to satisfy, each side trying to create a narrative which can make their political base more stronger. So we definitely are not getting the truth. But I have to say that there is so far no deal. It's all talks, wasting of time, and nothing more.
Right. Now, you wrote an article in March on frontpagemag.com that I really liked, and it was called The Pointlessness of the Two-Phase Nuclear Deal and Why Obama Needs for It to Look Like They Are Reaching a Deal. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The nuclear talks, the marathon nuclear, have been going on for 18 months. So there have been so much political capital spent on this. There's so much effort. So the U.S. foreign policy has focused so much on these issues that now break free from the deal is very costly for President Obama. So he will try to find any way to satisfy the Iranian leaders or to get a deal in order not to break free from these negotiations, because there's going to be a lot of criticism that you spent 2 years spending all this political power and all these resources on negotiating with the Iranian leader, and at the end you didn't reach any agreement, and you kept telling us that there's going to be agreement, we're going to remove the Iranian nuclear threat. So the administration, from my perspective, has been trying to always show that progress is going on. And if you notice, they missed the deadline several times, but still President Obama emphasized, go on, don't stop. Go on and just try to find something that we can say progress is being made. And again, the reason is that I think his policies in his Middle East policy was not really successful policies compared to other presidents in the region. I mean, you see the rise of Islamic State, you see the rise of Iran in different capitals in the Middle East. You see the Middle East is facing crisis which has never been to that level in modern history of the Middle East. So he tried to find something that at least when he leaves office, he said, you know, this was my, I have a record here. I made an agreement with Iran, but the agreement could be really a bad agreement. So he's been trying to show really that progress is being made. So going back to your question, he made the final stage two parts, two phases. One phase, which was March 31st, and one phase is June 30th. But what I was talking about is that, you know, after the interim deal was reached in 2013, there was no need, again, to make it two parts. Why do you have to have two phases? Why do you have to have one phase March 31st to reach a general framework, and then you have June 30th? And the reason I'm saying that they made it two phases, and the two phases was proposed by Obama administration, Secretary of State John Kerry, because they wanted, they didn't want to wait 6 months and people start saying, people start criticizing what is going on, or, you know, the allies particularly start saying that, you know, why the negotiations are not yielding results, why they are secretive. So they try to create other superficial phase, which is really nothing was delivered in that phase except some the talks. And then they try to say that, you know, progress is made. So now Congress be relaxed. We are doing progress, and everybody should be relaxed. We are improving. So, you know, these are all political games. Political game,
right.
just to convince people that everything is fine.
Well, and I also agree with you. I think, you know, he is trying to do something to leave a legacy, because he really doesn't have anything that isn't so far like a failed legacy that he can point to. And I think, you know, it is a legacy because he's, you know, he's excluded Congress. He doesn't want them involved at all, which under our Constitution, the founding fathers really wanted to have Congress involved in something that was major like this. I mean, that was some, you know, that was the intent. And he just ignores that. Now, he doesn't have to involve them, but again, that's the founding fathers, what they wanted. And I also just think that he, in a way, he's setting Iran up. It is my idea of what's happening, because he could say, oh, no, we had a deal back in April, you know, early April, we had a deal, and here's what it was. And he was so fast to go out and say, we have this, we agreed upon this, 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 and this. So
exactly.
So if it gets to the June deadline, he can say, you know what, we had a deal, but the Iranians backed out. It's their fault.
Right, exactly. And, you know, you mentioned something very interesting, you know, about the founding father and Congress. I mean, he exactly excluding Congress and not listening to what they're saying. And the funny thing is that when I follow the Iranian politics, I mean, it's an authoritarian, theocratic regime, but it's still their parliament has more power on their president now than President Obama letting the Congress to negotiate with, to at least to talk with him, to consult with him. I mean, it seems to me that President Obama's policies and reaction towards Congress is more authoritarian than what is going in Iran, because in Iran the parliament was saying, you know, was saying to the president, if you're going to have any deal, you should bring it to the parliament, Majlis calls, and we have to ratify it. And to some extent, he has to agree. I mean, if you have a theocratic regime that the president has to send something to the parliament to ratify it, so we are here living in a democratic country, so at least the president should listen to what the Congress is saying.
Right. I know. And it's a little humorous, but at the same time, it is very serious. I mean, it shows you where we are and how far we've gone the other way. And Congress should absolutely be involved in it.
Exactly.
I was going to ask you one thing. You know, my whole time I've been thinking, you know, why in the world are we involved with Iran in the first place? Yes, a legacy. I get that part, but there's so many, you know, red flags, if you will, that would show us that Iran really cannot be trusted and has no, no intentions, really, in my mind anyway, of following through on what they're sitting down and negotiating right now. I mean, if you look back at 1979, and everybody remembers the hostage taking, where mm-hmm. Americans were held for 444 days, people were killed in 1983 when an embassy was attacked again in 96, and then we have, 9/11, and on and on and on. Why are we sitting down with the Iranian government when we know the history?
Well, that's a great question, and I think the underlying reason is that there is no assertive, leadership in the U.S. now, in the particular Obama administration. By that, mm-hmm. I mean he doesn't like to take really strong, robust leadership in the region. You feel the American vacuum in the Middle East, and that's why you're really seeing all these conflicts just rising and Iran becoming more powerful. So he doesn't like to take the leadership, I think, status. And what is he doing? He's trying to be more conciliatory and try to give concession compromises to Iran to make them the satisfied and happy. So what is happening here is that if he doesn't go along with the Iranian, the other option would be to either increase sanction on Iranian because of the Iranian government of what they're doing in the region, but for sponsoring terrorism or for other activities or having underground nuclear sites, or to choose military option. And he doesn't want to choose any of these. He doesn't. These need strong leaders. If you want to really take a strong position in the region and to stabilize the region and to have to serve your own national interests, you have to be a strong leader. You can't be just a fragile leader who tries to make everybody happy. You have to make some stand somewhere. And he doesn't. He doesn't want to take that some stand. That's why you see Saudi Arabia started to launch its own strike in Yemen. It's saying that, we just confuse what is President Obama doing? What is Obama message talking to the Iranians, talking to us? They're not taking any action. So it's when you send the signal that our administration is a weak administration, which is trying to make everybody happy, then you will definitely definitely see the consequence and repercussions. And that's why I'm saying that he's started talking with the Iranian leaders because he doesn't want to take robust leadership in the region.
Now, do you think that with any type of nuclear deal that might be reached, will this change Iran's regional policies towards the United States?
Susan, in order to understand Iran, I lived there for 20 years. In order to understand the Iranian political system, we have to look at the foundation of this government. The foundation mm-hmm. of this government consists of two important elements. One, what we call the geopolitics, and the second one is ideological. The regime was founded based on the ideology of anti-Americanism and opposing American, opposing American foreign policy in the region and opposing Israel. These are two important tenets of this regime. So if we remove these tenets, then it's not going to be called anymore Islamic Republic of Iran. It's going to be a completely different government. So they're not going, the cleric system of Iran, the ruling cleric, they have to believe in these two important ideological tenets, which is anti-Americanism and opposing Israel in the region. So by that I mean, if you see even a nuclear deal being reached or whatever you see, if new president comes to power in Iran, those fundamental tenets which I just described will not go away. That's why for 30 years you're still seeing them coming. The Supreme Leader, even last week, he gave a speech demonizing U.S. Death to America or demonizing Israel. So this is how they get their legitimacy. If they say, you know, we are friend with America and we want to be friend with the American people and we want to, you know, have a good relationship, then they're going to lose their power. They're going to lose their legitimacy. They can't be. We won't have a ruling cleric, you know, in power. Then they have to come out of the power. So that's why they will forever stick to these two things, that we oppose America and we're going to oppose Israel. These two will not change. And, you know, I listened to both this Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei and Zarif, you know, the Iran foreign minister, recent statements. They exactly say the same thing. What they're saying is that, you know, we might reach a nuclear deal with America, but we have to tell them that our regional policy is off the table. And they said it from the beginning. Our regional policies will be off the table. Nobody will discuss it. And because they know that they're not going to change their policy. They're not going to become more moderate, even if you give them compromises, even if you remove sanctions against them. Because this is the nature of the regime, and the ideological part of the regime is very important, and it's not going really to go away, because if it goes away, they will lose their legitimacy within their institutions.
Well, and we know this about their regime, you know? I mean, the Obama administration knows that this what the regime is about. They've always been that way, and they're always going to be that way. And I guess he probably hopes that the American people will think, oh, well, if we can just be nice, they'll be nice back.
Susan, that's a great thing. Sorry to interrupt you. I have to just distinguish between the Iranian government and Iranian people. I mean, mm-hmm. I live there, and I have to tell you, majority of Iranian people are really pro-American. They love America. I mean, I watched tweets. I watched some of the news that you know, people like when one U.S. official is shown on U.S. and Iranian TV, people take mm-hmm. selfies. Iranian people take selfies. They love American culture. They know all the singers. They know all the movie actors. They know a lot of things about America, and they love to come here. So Iranian, you know, are really in the region, you can say, among the Iranian people, among the most pro-American, society. And I think, you know, American people, Iranian people, they like to interact with each other. But I think the regime is different in Iran. So as you know, the regime has its own also, you know, selectorate, or what we call loyalists. Those are the people who go to the street and say death to America. But, you know, majority of Iranian people are young people who do not like their own government. And they know they are a liar. They always say that. They used to tell me, you know, if you want the real news, is that whatever you hear from Iranian leader, just make it opposite. Then that will be the truth. Whatever they say, if they said it's night, then it will be actually it's morning, it's not night. Uh-huh. There is a distinction, just I wanted to make. I don't want to generalize the whole about Iran, that all of them are the same.
Yeah, no, and you know, I mean, even in America, we feel that same way, many of us, about, you know, Obama, because it's, you know, it's unbelievable kind of what he does and what we're seeing America turn into. We've never seen this before, and it's certainly not the America and the freedoms that we used to have here. So I think we probably have a lot more in common in some respects with the Iranian people than we know.
I think he's using, he's really exploiting, I think, his executive power.
Absolutely.
And I think that's been unprecedented.
And do most people in Iran, I mean, you just kind of said how they feel about us, and do they feel that Americans, you know, can be trusted, those people who are in favor of America, and the other ones who are sort of following the regime, what are their opinions about America?
You know, it's a mix. So you mean what they think of American people or what they think of American government?
The American government and the deals that we're making right now. Do they think that
okay.
Americans can be trusted in the deal
with this nuclear
weapon deal?
Well, we're talking about two different groups. So let's say the
mm-hmm.
the young people who are opposed to the Iranian regime, the ones who protested, let's say, in 2009, who want to change the regime. Yes, I mean, those people trust American governments. I'm talking generally, so they really they probably don't know that much about the intricacies or the differences between Obama's administration or other administrations. They generally
right.
trust American public and American government. They love them. So it's but there is a group like let's say those who work for the regime, who make money from the regime, like. Let's say IRGC, Iran Revolutionary Guards Corps, or Basij, which is a militia in Iran founded in 1979. Those people who work for the regime, they absolutely use the line which is the regime is using, that we can't trust America. The Supreme Leader
uh-huh.
keeps saying that. The Supreme Leader keeps every speech saying that we can't trust these people. They use that line. But I have to tell you that even some of those people who work for the regime, like the lower level, those people who just want to make money and live like normal soldiers or something, some of them, they might say, they might repeat the line the government is, but when you
mm-hmm.
become friend with them, I mean, there were several of them, like the besieges or, those like guards. When you become friends with them, they are lower level. They say, I want to be honest with you. I really don't like it here. And some of them, like in a humorous way, would say, how can I get a green card to come to the States? And so it's like in Iranian mind, they love technology, they love advanced country, and they have it like Iranian people. They have a special, feeling towards the United States.
And can you talk a little bit about Yemen and what's going on there and why Iran is in
mm-hmm. it? And that's a great question. So Yemen, what you're seeing in Yemen is basically a proxy war, I call it. You see a series of proxy war going on across the region. In Yemen is
mm-hmm.
one of them. So you have... one of the powerful Shiite group called the Houthis, a militant. These are supported by the Iranian government. They want to take over the government of Yemen. So the president now is in hiding. Even the president, which was elected President Hadi, because of the advancement of this militia group, and because they took over Sana'a and they took over different city. So now what happened is that Iran is supporting these Houthis because they are Shia, they are from the same Islamic branch, and they serve the interests of the Iranian leaders. And also, Yemen has a border with Saudi Arabia. So there is a tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Iran sees itself as a leader of a Shia Muslim, and Saudi Arabia sees itself as a leader of Sunni Muslim. So they have some
right.
kind of, Cold War going on. So Iran wants to use Yemen to have power over Saudi Arabia, because Yemen is a neighbor of Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia became very alarmed by what was going in Yemen, and it started I heard from some of their own people is that, U.S. is not doing anything. Iran now is in control of four capitals in the region, four Arab capitals, Sana'a, Baghdad, Damascus, and Beirut, and we're not going to let the Iranian government to interfere in the Arab world. So Saudi Arabia started their upper, what I call decisive operation, going ahead and striking the Houthis, the militant, the Shia militant, which are supported by Iran. And so Iranian are sending weapons and funds to the Houthis. So you see a proxy war going inside Yemen. The Saudis want to defeat the Houthis, and the Iranian want to get the Houthis to gain power in Yemen. So that's what you're really seeing in Yemen. It's more of a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
And it's just so strange. So here we are again. You know, the United States is sitting down at a negotiating table with Iran, and we're supposed to be, you know, negotiating this nuclear weapons deal. And at the same time, we're sending money to Saudi Arabia to support them while they, you know, fight the Iranians. It, I mean, it absolutely makes no sense.
Right. That's exactly what you see on the Arab or Persian like news. Sometimes they're like confused. They're saying like, what kind of, the Saudis are particularly saying that we just don't understand. They try to help us here, but they also sitting on a negotiating table with Iran. They're trying to lift the sanctions against Iran, and they're not pressing Iran at all with what going on in the region. Obama agreed, you know, he acquiesced that, you know, to the Iranian leaders that, you know, I'm going to let you do whatever you want in the region. You have your own policies. You can be interventionist. You can just go and take over all the capitals in the Middle East. We don't care. Just let me get the deal with you because I want to have a good legacy when I leave the office. So that's basically what you're seeing, that the Obama administration not putting any pressure on Iran. For the first time, they're not even telling Iran why you're sponsoring these groups, why you're sponsoring that terrorist group. Nothing. There is no criticism of Iranian government for the first time, and that's why they are empowered and emboldened. And when they are empowered and emboldened and there is an American vacuum in the region, no leadership, the Saudis will take their own, initiatives. They're going to start their own bombardment of different places. And what you see, the destabilization of the region, and that will damage the U.S. national interest, particularly when it comes to economy and strategic interest. So I think, you're right. The trigger is a weak leadership from here, from Washington and from the White House. That's the trigger which is leading to all these intensified and militarized conflicts going on there.
And how much do you think our negotiations with Iran is done to sort of put, quote unquote, you know, put Iran in, I mean, Israel in its place?
You mean how did the Iranian government is pressuring Israel, or you mean how the White House is reacting toward Israel?
I mean, we all know that Obama and Netanyahu right now are, you know, there's a lot of strained relationships between them,
right.
Especially what happened, you know, with Netanyahu coming and speaking before Congress, and Obama didn't want that, and on and on and on. Here, you know, Israel is supposed to be our friend and ally, and we're sitting down negotiating
right.
with Iran. We won't make Iran say that they won't destroy Israel. I'm wondering how much of this is Obama just sort of saying to Netanyahu, you know, this is what you get. You know, we're sort of punishing you, if you will, and we're mm-hmm. dealing with Iran. How much do you think that is?
No, I think that's true. I mean, that's really the the detrimental message that's being sent from the White House to closest ally. You
mm-hmm.
won't leave your closest strategic and geopolitical ally off the hook and not tell them anything about what is going on. Particularly when you have only one good or, you know, strategic and geopolitical ally in the region, which try to serve the national interests of the United States. So what is happening, I think what is, I totally agree with you. I think the problem here is that President Obama is the administration is keeping everything secretive when it comes to the deal, because they know that if they let everything public, their allies will be alarmed. Their allies would say that, you know, this is clearly not a good deal. This is a deal which is leaving Iran with a path to become a nuclear state, to obtain nuclear weapons. So I think he's undermining the Israeli leadership in the region, and that's what the what the Iranian government is really, I think, loves to see. I mean, they've been really happy about what is going on, particularly President Obama ignoring the Congress and ignoring Israel, its ally, and sitting on the negotiating table with Iran and ignoring basically all the allies U.S. has and all the, you know, all the constitutional rights that Congress has. So it's I think from the Iranian perspective, Iranian government perspective, this is the best President Obama is the best politician they can ever find to serve their own interests, because he's undermining the Israeli leadership in the region, and ignoring the threats that they might be encountered from Iran's hegemonic ambition in the region and interventionist policies.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. I can get your point about it, how it emboldens them, because it looks like, you know, that Obama is just going out on his own against his own government, against the Israeli government, and he's playing right into the hands of the Iranian government, and they just must be beside themselves, joy, over how easy this is and how they continue to manipulate the Obama administration and how we continue to just give in to every demand that they want. We just kind of give in to that and allow them to have whatever they want. It's a totally one-sided agreement for what we've been told, you know, in the news.
Yes, yes. Yes, I mean, you know, when the negotiations started, there were several UN Security Council resolutions demanding Iran to stop its nuclear activity completely. So we started with the premise negotiation that Iran has to stop its nuclear activities, has to stop its nuclear sites or underground or like the one in Fordo or other nuclear research. So that was the premise we started with. That's what Prime Minister Netanyahu is saying. And that was the UN Security Council resolution. But then when the negotiations kept going on, Iranian government is very sophisticated. They sent a very soft face of people who can speak diplomatically, but they serve the interests of the supreme leader of Iran. So they send the people who can smile to the negotiating tables, and they know that President Obama is weak. And President Obama was the one who started to give concessions. So we started with no nuclear activities to little by little to some enrichment of uranium, then the level increased, then it was from 1,000 centrifuges, it went to 2,000 centrifuges they can keep, then it went to 6,000 centrifuges. So it keeps going on. Now we know that the Iran, Javad Zarif tweeted 2 days ago, he was bragging, the deal said that we will not close any nuclear sites in Iran. How about that? So they're not going to close anything. The sanctions going to be removed. And after 10 years, they want to be allowed to enrich as many at the level that they want. They want to have as many advanced centrifuges as they want. So basically, that's the best deal they can ever get.
Well, and pretty soon, you know, it's going to get to the point they're going to think that we're going to, you know, have Obama go over there and help them make that nuclear weapon. It just keeps going this way, you know. Why they can just expect
to
move because that's what they're getting.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And you know, about Israel, also something interesting that just comes to my mind, and it reflects the weakness of Obama administration is that they have created a front actually near the border of Israel in Syria, Iranian forces, IRGC. Now they have a front near Golan Heights. They brought fighters from Shia fighters from different countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, and from Iran, and they have stationed them there. So this is really unprecedented. They have forces near the border of Israel, and you hear nothing from President Obama criticizing that. I mean, we're talking about the one of the best ally U.S. has in the region is being threatened by forces near its border, and you hear no words from the Obama administration. And I think that's very alarming.
Well, sort of switching thoughts a minute here, can you explain to us a little bit about Iran's belief in the return of the Mahdi and how this is similar to, you know, what ISIS believes in with the caliphate?
Yes, so I have to start with, you know, there are two branches, as I mentioned, in Islam, one Sunni and one Shia. The Shia believe that there were 12 successors after Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, and they call them imams. And the 12th one, which is his name is Mahdi, they believe he disappeared suddenly, and he's going to come back one day and kill all the infidels, kill everybody who's against Islam, and he's going to Islam will be victorious, particularly Shia Islam, and they will rule. So that is the perception. This is what the Iranian leaders believe. So their perception is that one day they're going to rule, Mehdi going to come, they're going to help the cleric in Iran, and they're going to be ruling all over the world. The perception of the Islamic State, which are Sunni, their perception is that the life that that was created, the political system which was created at the time of Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, that is going to occur again, and they're going to rule the world, and that is the caliphate. They're going to be a caliph, and they're going to rule away. So there is some kind of same premise underlying this, both ideologies, that they're going to rule the world, and there is going to be a Sharia system. Shia or Sunni, doesn't matter, it's Islamic both. So it's going to be Islamic system based on Quran, the verses of Quran, and they believe, they strongly believe in this, that they're going to rule the world. They're going to have control over the world. The Shia, the Iranian leader, believe that Mehdi is going to help them. He's going to come on a horse with a sword, and going to kill everyone, and then they're going to be victorious. The Islamic Caliphate believe that they should do it themselves. They should do it now. They don't have to wait for anyone. They just go ahead and keep killing, and they're going to conquer the world. So these are two different ideology, you see.
Now, what do you think that, you know, Iran's, like, their short-term and long-term goals towards the U.S. in general? I know the Mahdi and taking over and all that is one thing, but what do you think their long-term and short-term goals are towards the United States?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I believe, from my experience living there, from years of studying the system and doing research, as long as you have this regime in power, the cleric system, you're not going to have good relationship. They're not going to have good relationship with the U.S. government. So they will always view U.S. as an enemy, as a Satan, great Satan, Israel, both Israel and the United States. So this is the underlying foundation of the system. So they're not going to change that. For short term or long term, the reason they're now talking, they're just negotiating with the U.S. diplomat, is that because they want to remove the sanction against the government. It's not because they're trying to have a rapprochement, a better relationship with the United States. They just want to lift the sanctions and become more powerful. But definitely you're not going to see good relationship between the theocratic regime of Iran and U.S. because Iran had spent billions of dollars in the region to fight U.S. Objectives, to fight Israel, to help Hamas, to help groups which fight with Israel. So it's very unrealistic to think that they're going to one day say, okay, what, you know what, we spend all this money and we're going to change our ideology and we're going to not support Hezbollah, not support any group anymore, and we're going to be just like Sweden. We're going to be a good ally of the. This is just unrealistic, and you can't change it, and they can't. You know, they define themselves as Islamic Republic, Islamic government. So they're not going to change their view that the U.S. is a Satan, Israel is a Satan. So this is my perspective. Unless you see really a change in the regime, and hopefully you see some more moderate, better government coming to power. You know, Iran was a close ally of the United States before this cleric came to power.
Right. And do you ever see Iran sort of being willing to work with Russia and China if it meant destroying, you know, destroying Israel or the United States?
Well, they definitely. I mean, they are close ally with the Russia and China. So they must have revenues that come from oil or other trades come from working or trading with Russia and China. Yes, of course they what they say, Iranian leader, they say that they have created an Eastern Axis, which is Iran / Russia / China. And I think it's very brilliant that you brought up these three countries, because that's what the Iranian leaders say. They call them Eastern Axis. And they say the Eastern Axis is going to defeat the Western Axis, which is the U.S. And Western allies, European countries, and Israel also is part of it, though it's not in Europe, but they call them U.S. allies. So definitely, I mean, Iran will use Russia and China, and, you know, Russian leaders are also happy to undermine U.S. Power and U.S. leadership. So, of course, I think they're going to use Russia and China militarily and also economically to undermine U.S. and U.S. Power, also Israel in the region.
Now, you had also written another article for the World Post called Iran's Strategic Geopolitical and Economic Politics of 2015. Can you kind of give us an idea of what that article was about?
Was it about I write a lot of articles, so I don't remember. Was it about the one that?
Yes.
So I mean, what I noticed is that they spent. I looked at the statistics and their numbers. So their majority of their budget is going to go through spending money on their IRGC, which is again the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's a ideological forces in Iran, and also Quds forces. Quds force is a foreign branch of IRGC that they go to different countries and they intervene and they spy and they fight, and they are now fighting in different countries. The budget, most of the budget of Iran is going to that, instead of going really to the Iranian people who are desperately in need of job or different kind of economic assistance. So that's their plan for 2015, and it's interesting. I mean, instead of becoming more moderate, they're becoming actually more radical. They're spending money on their forces, which are intervening in different countries, and their goal definitely is to The strategic, the regional goal is to increase their aggressive policies in the region and to have control more. Now they have control over four capitals in the region. They want to have more control over other countries in the region. I think it's, again, it shows how the more aggressive they have become towards other countries. Of course, domestically speaking, they're going to, there is a trend of always there being oppressiveness, but they're trying to oppress human rights group. And they recently they were saying that United States should lift sanctions which are related to human rights issues in Iran. They don't want UN monitor Iran human rights group anymore. They don't want any kind of observation. So they want to have more control commit more atrocity against them. Yeah, so it's this is really domestically and internationally speaking, this is the plan for 2015.
I was going to say it sounds like they're more moving towards, you know, creating the chaos and bringing back the Mahdi. They must feel kind of certain that the Mahdi is coming back soon, and they're ramping up to try to make that happen, it seems. Or
yes,
you know,
yes, it's exactly like what you said, Susan. You know, I went to their they have like what they call morning sessions every week in Iran, and I would just go to see what is it like. And these people who believe in Mahdi, they really believe. I mean, they believe this is true, and what they're saying is that we have to help him to come back. And the way we help him to come back is just continue forcefully his mission. If we don't continue his mission, then we are also like other infidels. We have to continue his mission of, you know, removing all the people who are against Islam or all the people who don't agree with us. So I think you're absolutely right. It's towards that mission of Mahdi.
Well, and it also seems like, too, you know, I know that there's Sunnis and the Shias, and they're two different Muslims, but, you know, it almost looks like they're looking at ISIS and going, wow, you know, ISIS is moving quickly. They've called for a caliphate in June, and, you know, we ought to just do the same thing they're doing. Or if they're not looking at ISIS and doing that, they certainly seem to be going in the same direction, maybe for different reasons, but... You know?
Yeah, because, you know, now you have competition, and when you have competition, you're going to have more conflict going on. You're going to see more. They try more to, you know, to intervene, to kill other people, because they're competing with each other now. Iran,
right.
The Shia version is competing with the Sunni version, and they will kill as many people as they can, or use their military or forces to show the other side, you know, my version of ideology is more correct than yours.
Wow. And just in general, we have a couple minutes left. You know, what do you think, like, everyday life is for most Iranians? I know it's a kind of a generalized question, but...
Right. No, it's a great question. I think it's, you know, it's a little complicated. So... By living in Iran, I really noticed that most, you know, it's a very young generation. Most of the people, more than 50% of the people are under 30 years old. And these people, they are really discontent with the regime. They don't like the government. They want, you know, just to feel free. Particularly like women or even young men, they want like to live like young people here in the United States, to listen to music, you know, to be able to wear what they like, to have parties, or to not to be observed by a moral police always. It was funny. I mean, I was a couple of times stopped by the moral police for the way I was wearing my dress. My clothes. So it's you know, they really it's very difficult for them, and the unemployment rate is very high. And most of Iranians I know, they're educated people, and they're trying to immigrate. They trying to go to Canada or try to go to different countries. So it's very difficult, but they're just getting along with it, and they're hoping that one day they can change the system. They don't like the mullah system or the ayatollah system at all. I mean, people are, you find them really secular. They don't like religion to rule over them.
Well, and I understand. We have about 10 seconds, so I need to say goodbye. Thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate your being here and for all that you do, and thanks again.
Thank you so much, Susan. I enjoyed it, and I wish you continuous success. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Majid. Bye-bye.
Have a good
so
day.
So there you have it. Bye-bye. There you have it. We'll
okay,
see you next week. Everyone, stay safe, and we'll see you next week on Stanford Truth Radio. Take care.